Kia ora and welcome to this episode of Better Off Red. I'm Pip Adam and it's raining. It's raining in Wellington. The Warriors are playing tonight and it's going to rain all over them, I think. Wet rugby league players. So stay inside where it's dry and enjoy this episode of Better Off Red, where I talk to Joe Buchanan about Stanislaw Lem's 1961 book, Solaris. It was a fantastic talk. I really enjoyed speaking with Joe. Joe and I have been friends for a long time. I first met him in Dunedin and then we both ended up living in Wellington, which has been great. He is a fantastic, he's a very interesting thinker and he writes beautifully as well, although you don't get to read a lot of his writing, but he's a great writer. And he's also a very talented scientist. He's a biologist. He works in biological science, and his PhD, which he talks about in this episode, looked at genetic variation of certain algae, wait till they hear him. Anyway, he's fantastic to talk to, and it was super exciting for me to talk to a scientist about a science fiction novel. It was just great to get that sort of discipline in a room to talk about what it is we do when we read and write science fiction. It was wonderful. And of course, you know, this is one of my favourite books. It was really funny. I didn't realise how important this book was to me until I sort of re-skimmed and read over bits of it for this podcast. You know, I think it forms a huge basis of the last thing I wrote. It's really interesting. Anyway, we had a great chat and I really hope you enjoy it. If you're listening to this on iTunes, it would really help us if you left a comment. We are on Facebook and we're also on Twitter. On Twitter, we're at BetterRedNZ. Pop in, say hi. Thank you very much.
Chapter 1, The Arrival. At 1900 hours, ship's time, I made my way to the launching bay. The men around the shaft stood aside to let me pass, and I climbed down into the capsule. Inside the narrow cockpit, there was scarcely room to move. I attached the hose to the valve on my spacesuit, and it inflated rapidly. From then on, I was incapable of making the smallest movement. There I stood, or rather, hung, suspended, enveloped in my pneumatic suit and yoke to the metal hull. I looked up. Through the transparent canopy, I could see a smooth, polished wall and, far above, Moddard's head leaning over the top of the shaft. He vanished, and suddenly I was plunged into darkness. The heavy protective cone had been lowered into place. 8 times I heard the hum of the electric motors, which turned the screws, followed by the hiss of the shock absorbers. As my eyes grew accustomed to the dark, I could see the luminous circle of the solitary dial. A voice echoed in my headphones. "Ready, Calvin?" "Ready, Moddard," I answered. "Don't worry about a thing. The station will pick you up in flight. Have a good trip." There was a grinding noise and the capsule swayed. My muscles tensed in spite of myself, but there was no further noise or movement. "When is liftoff?" As I asked, I noticed a rustling outside like a shower of fine sand. "You're on your way, Calvin. Good luck." Moddard's voice sounded as close as before. A wide slit opened at eye level, and I could see the stars.
Okay, so here we are. I'm here with Joe Buchanan. How are you, Joe?
I'm good.
That's good. It's kind of a sunny day. We are going to be talking about Solaris by Stanislaw Lem. And I just realised there's going to be a lot of Russian names. And we could.
We'll just have to cope as best as we can.
Yes, we will give it a go. I was thinking today about just rereading over this book. I was thinking what a massive influence it was on my last piece of writing on working on a building. I just realised how
Yeah, I came across it in a weird way. I watched a movie which was called He Died with a Falafel in His Hand, which was an Australian movie. And there's a scene where one of the characters asks another character to tell them a story. And this person tells them a story about a spaceship that's orbiting a planet. And I remember someone saying to me, I think that's Solaris. And that's how I was intrigued just by the bare bones of the story to go. And I think first, embarrassingly, I saw the Soderbergh, and then I read the book, and the book just absolutely mesmerised me. I love it. It's one of my favourite books. Can you remember when you first read it?
No, I was trying to remember. I saw the Tarkovsky version as a teenager,
mm-hmm.
and then started looking around for the book and never could find it. Then must have been 15 or 20 years later that I read the book.
Mm.
Yeah, I always look for Lem, but he's hard to find.
Yeah, he's an interesting figure, eh? Like, you know way more about him than me.
I don't know
about that. But you've read a lot more of him than me, and I always like the way you talk about how this is one of his more sort of, I don't want to use the word serious, but can you talk a little bit about some of the other work?
I haven't read him thoroughly, but Solaris is his serious novel compared to his other books. There are funny bits in Solaris, or there are bits that verge on satire, but his other books are often outright satires, where he'll write, he's written a whole book of reviews of other books that don't exist. He's written pseudo-scientific papers and this sort of thing, and a lot of them are funny. And also some bits which, I suppose, predate Hitchhiker's Guide, but have similar humour of ridiculous situations and paradoxes in space, and they're laugh out loud funny. Whereas Solaris, you feel like there's satire in here. He's making fun of things, but at the same time he's exploring the ideas in a fairly straight sort of way, and there is enough of a science fiction plot of alien contact and space exploration to give it a feel of a more straightforward science fiction book.
And so what sort of things does he satirise, do you think, in all of his work? Like, what's the sort of social context that he's writing in, maybe?
He's satirising science and intellectualism in general, I think, and how we explore the world. In Solaris, I think there's a lot of... the satire is about science's inability to move beyond description. So he has lengthy passages in the book where they're describing the alien planet, but this is not giving them any insights into the nature of the planet or what this means, and there's no understanding of the meaning, but there's almost relentless detail, and there's references to thousands of hours of film that has been made and numerous expeditions and a huge volume of literature about the planet, well, none of which has helped us understand this alien planet, or indeed if it's an alien entity, or if it is intelligence. We can't understand that. We're too trapped by human ways of thinking. And that's interesting in science, because natural science often runs a very difficult path in between the things that we can describe but not understand and the things we can actually answer questions about. A lot of the trouble with science is trying to find a question that is meaningful but answerable. There's plenty of questions which are answerable but trivial and obvious, and then there's plenty of questions which are almost impossible to answer or very difficult, and half the difficulty with science is choosing a question that's worth answering but can be answered. And I think Solaris has a lot to say about trying to find an actual question that they can answer about something which is an alien planet.
And if just sort of thinking about that, what do you think is the question that they should be asking about Solaris?
Well, I think the point is they don't have a question they can answer, because they can't get outside of their human rational way of thinking and their human view of the universe, and they're trying to answer a question about something which is actually alien. And how do you even find a question to ask? You have to have some understanding before you can ask a question. And they're trying to formulate it. At the end of the novel, I think he's falling back to something different, intuition or empathy,
mm-hmm.
and maybe he's abandoning rationality, which I don't know. I mean, I think Lem is a fan of rationality, but he's talking about the limits of science and the limits of knowledge.
Mm.
How do you understand something which probably isn't an individual?
Mm.
You know, the idea of an intelligence that's not an individual is very hard to comprehend.
Because that's what's really interesting, is I was reading one of the earlier, I think in The Monsters, he talks about the storm and says, oh, you know, the one being that obviously controls them, you know, like, because, yeah, you just see that falling away, you know, his whatever character arc or whatever seems to be toward this falling away in some ways, eh, Chris? You know, like, this sort of, you know, like, what it ends is with that beautiful moment with the ocean in the hand and the, you know what I mean, like, it seems to move to just this physical kind of thing. I don't know,
where there seems to be an element of communication that's not rationally understood. So yeah, he seems to be communicating with something, another intelligence of some sort, but he's given up on trying to rationalize it or test it. Yeah, so he's looking maybe for a different way of understanding things.
Yeah, because this is what I think, this is why the book was so important to me at the time and continues to be important, because I am always interested in what lies outside, you know. I always, and you can help me as a scientist, because Brent always laughs at me with this, but I always have this idea that if we seek to find out something with a mind that believes something, we will prove ourselves right. Do you know what I mean? And I think that's sort of tying into that thing you were asking, you were saying about questions. And I guess, you know, for me, it's often about, and, you know, because of the animal rights stuff, it's often about, you know, like, we might call a chicken dumb, but a chicken can do some spatial processing that we can't. So what does the world look like to a chicken? You know, like, and just that whole Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy idea that are the dolphins experimenting on us rather than us experimenting on dolphins. But this is what excites me so much about the book, is that we keep coming to those edges, eh? Like, we can't, you know, like, it feel, you really feel the boundaries of human whatever it is. Do you reckon?
Yeah, I mean, we have difficulty with people from other cultures and understanding how they think, let alone other species. You know, do animals think? We anthropomorphize so much, and we anthropomorphize machines and cars and things like that. How can we possibly even understand an animal that evolutionarily is so close to us? It's very little difference between an ape and a human in evolutionary terms, but then if we were giving something like an alien intelligence, how would we understand it?
Yeah, that's what I just loved about it, because I think that was the shift for me. Because before that, when I was thinking about how do I write about buildings in a way that's different, everybody seemed to have made them into humans, you know what I mean? Like, they were all tied into human ideas of hubris, or, you know, and then there was, you know, Kipling had done some incredible work where he'd written these stories where he'd sort of, they were from the point of view of trains and things like that, and they felt like robot science fiction, some of these, and like, I kind of, yeah, I just wonder about, and then what was weird, because when I read Solaris, like you say, it sort of seemed to end that idea of turning this alien thing into human and turn it into something that I can't understand, kind of. Now, there are these visitors who arrive who, you know, I was just reading over that as well, and I was thinking that sort of talks to something about kind of what is it to be human and what is it not to be human, you know, like, you know, Raya, eh? Is that
Raya or Ari, depending on the book or the movie, the translator, I think.
So Raya, you know, like, I was just reading the bits where it's that awful thing where she doesn't know she's not her. So is she her? You know, like, I'm just wondering, what do you think about those kind of bits of the book?
Well, I think Lem is interested in meeting an alien. I think it is a science fiction book, unlike, you know, most science fiction books, which are I think most. Maybe it's unfair because I don't read much contemporary science fiction, but most science fiction books seem to be adventures or soap operas or romances, whatever, rather than books that are really about science or the possibilities that science, because science has created this possibility that we could encounter an alien life form, maybe. Who knows? And how would it communicate with us? And if it sends us ghosts from our past that are constructed as an alien's idea of what a human might be or what a human might want? I don't know where I'm going with this.
It's such an interesting idea because I've never, I think it's that thing that, because I was coming in at, I was knee deep in a creative writing PhD when I was reading it, I was coming at it to this idea of how do you communicate, how do you tell story, how do you, and I always think of Raya and the Visitors as kind of like Morse code or something there's some kind of trying to communicate. But this idea that she is sort of the embodiment of what the planet, I don't know, I'm going to call it the planet, sort of thinks as a way that it can talk to them is just an incredible idea.
Yeah, maybe. Or maybe the planet's trying to grant a wish,
Yeah.
It's, Raya is just drawn from Chris's memories. Mm. It's not... It's implied in the book that there is no existence that is not just drawn from his memory. So it's not Raya in that sense. But then it appears that these visitors become more and more autonomous and become their own people.
Mm.
They grow up in a few weeks and the time they're there. But maybe that's a planet, the planet trying to provide something that humans want.
Yeah.
But as it turns out, often... disastrously so, Raya's the most well-rounded of the visitors. The others seem to be almost freaks, and the others are getting freaks and fantasies. Raya is somebody from Chris's past that he feels guilty about. I don't think there's any answer, and I think that's deliberate, because there's no answers in the novel. It's a series of paradoxes and quandaries, and that's intended, because that is what you get at the limits of intelligence. That's what you get at the limits of rational exploration. If you're talking about something alien, then the novel itself has to be limited and unsatisfying. Yeah.
Because I was thinking that about it. There's a real enjoyment for me in the fact that it doesn't answer itself, and it kind of leaves this door swinging that I keep bumping into in my daily life. You know what I mean? I'll look at something and I think, and I think there is something really interesting about that. I was really interested by your comment that this is science fiction as opposed to adventure, and it was interesting because I've just I've been thinking a lot about a book called The Martian, which is a new book, and I was thinking how it's helpful what I'm running at the moment, because it is an adventure tale, it's like a survival kind of Robinson Crusoe sort of thing. And I was wondering about this idea of science fiction. When I was walking up here, I was thinking, what the hell does that mean? I always think about Thomas Hardy, and I think how he was sort of interacting with Darwin's ideas, and often his books are about survival of the fittest and, that kind of thing. And I'm thinking, well, why is that not science fiction or a realist novel where we're walking through time and touching things? And yet, when you go to the science fiction section in the bookshop, it's often, space opera and, what did Lem call that? Lovers in Space. I'll come back to that. But what do you think separates science fiction from those other things like adventure and romance and, that kind of thing, soap opera?
I don't know, but you'd expect it to have science as a theme of the... novel or the book, that science would be in the writing, and it wouldn't be just technology. You have to distinguish between technology, spaceships and lasers and so forth, and books which use that as a proxy for science. Which is funny, because quite a lot of science fiction writers who are scientists, the older generation that I read when I was a teenager, don't seem to be particularly interested in science. You know, they're interested in technology. They're interested in the possibilities that technology might provide, and that's sort of mildly interesting, but not as interesting as the whole questions about scientific inquiry, which I suppose a lot of scientists are not interested in, really. There's a lot of scientists who are not that interested in the philosophy of science. They just they go out there and they do it, and they find an area they can work in. They probably do very good work, but you know, they don't necessarily think about how they do that work and where that's leading us.
And I guess, like, I mean, that seems like that's important for you, eh?
I think about it all the time, probably more than I do actual science, which is probably detrimental if you want a career in science, because you really need to go out there and find things out and write them up.
And how did that affect your PhD? Like, your PhD is about phytobiology, yeah? Is that right word? Algae. So, did you have a research question that you were trying to work out? Is that how a science PhD works?
It should, perhaps, but I was interested in a group of algae. I thought there were questions I could answer, but I had to get some data first before I could really formulate a question, and that's often the case if you're working on species that haven't been worked on much before. As it was, I was able to develop some quite good questions along the way, which is about genetic variation and speciation and evolutionary history of algae, seaweeds around New Zealand, and that was interesting. Probably not big questions, small questions about how individual species work, but it gave me a lot of a chance to think about species formation and how we describe species, and that's also something, an area that is plagued by anthropomorphic restraints and how we look at species, and also it's been plagued by, I think, what I might call zoological normativism, where animals are the basis for a lot of our thinking about other species, and not all species work as easily as animals or in the same way as animals. A lot of plants hybridize. Species boundaries don't seem to be as fixed. The evolution appears to be slower in terms of molecular change. So I spent a lot of time thinking about these questions and about history. And this is, I suppose, a question about determinism against... What's the opposite of determinism?
Choice? No.
I've lost the word. Things happen. Things happen. Contingency. Okay, it's determinism versus contingency. Do things evolve in a certain way because of laws that we can understand, or are they evolving in a certain way because of one-off events that happen sometime in geological history or species interactions? Do species emerge because they're adapting to a particular environment, or do species emerge because a little bit of the population got cut off from the rest and it just went on to evolve on an independent evolutionary trajectory? Yeah, these are quite major questions in biology, and we don't really have clear ideas.
Because I remember you, like... I remember you helping me out once, because I had this idea that I really... Sorry, I'm going to throw you in the deep end now, but I remember once you saying to me, and it wasn't that long ago, that things don't really adapt to their environment. Do you remember talking about that? How I had this idea that, you know, the food was high up, so the giraffe's neck got longer. But that's not the truth, is it? Like, what happened is... the ones with the long necks started eating those, and that mutation.
Theoretically, everything in evolution happens by accident.
Ah, I love this.
There's variation in a species. Some giraffes have longer necks, and those ones do better than the ones that don't, but they didn't get longer necks so they could eat high trees. They happen to get longer necks, and quite often they will have got something for a completely different reason for the reason they put it to. You know, elephants did not develop noses so they could... move tree trunks around. Who knows why they did it? Why did giraffes get long necks? You know, it's been suggested that probably the evolutionary force for getting long necks, the selection was so they could eat higher things, but it could have been for males competing because they fight for mates by banging their necks together, and you know, that's a possible explanation. There's a lot of storytelling in evolution where people look at current function and decide, well, that's why that happened. You know, why are there so many flightless birds in New Zealand? Because there weren't any predators to eat them? Or is there another reason? Was it because there was less competition on the ground? So it wasn't escape from predation, and they didn't need wings, so they lost them. You know, evolutionary loss is another question. It's quite hard to quantify and to analyse why things get lost. Presumably there's a disadvantage in having wings, otherwise you'd never lose them. But if you don't need them, you lose them. It's just a cost and energy to maintain something. But maybe birds have lost their wings because they didn't need them to find mates or to find food. If there's no other competition for food, then probably don't need to forage over a wide area, so they lose their wings because there's plenty of food available. Maybe escape from predation wasn't the driving force. But they're very hard to tell, these questions, because they happen in history and they happen across a time frame that we find very hard to understand. It's very hard to analyse anything over more than 20 or 30 years in your own lifetime, let alone in the lifetime of a species.
Because you see, this again, it's, you see, this is all tying in with that idea that, you know, we do tell stories around and we try to explain. And I was just thinking, and this, you can, this is the reason that scientists and logical, rational people often laugh at me, but I was just thinking, like, we're saying sex, food, survival, but for all we know, could there be another motivation that we don't even know about? Like, is it at all possible that, you know, birds have a sense that we don't even know about? Like, you know, that was another thing we've been talking about a little bit, is that idea of perception versus, you know, empathy, or, you know, that kind of thing. And, you know, is it at all possible that there is a reason outside our understanding that that happened? Or is that crazy?
Well, the logic of evolution is that it's all about reproduction, ultimately, that if you have more successful offspring, then you're going to do better than the competitors in your species, and that your genes will be passed on. But how you do that and what makes a difference is very difficult to say. I mean, humans, reproductive success is very hard to tie down, because it's not linked to material success. It's not necessarily linked to attractiveness or something, anything like that. It's and of course that's modified massively by culture, but to talk about culture and other organisms is difficult. How do we understand the culture of intelligent organisms like dolphins that live in a completely alien environment or something? I don't know how intelligent dolphins really are. Ape culture, you know, grooming. I was thinking about grooming and apes. You know, apes spend a lot of time grooming, and maybe that's much more important to them than sex. But sex seems to be obviously linked to reproduction, but maybe grooming is, has a lot, maybe being a good groomer. Can we understand what it means to be a good groomer? You were trained as a hairdresser. You know,
it's totally important.
A hairdresser is the you know, epitome of human evolution. I don't know.
Because I was just thinking with dolphins, like, I've been doing a lot of reading about dolphins, and it seems that we want to call them intelligent because they'll do what we ask them to do. Like, that just seems to be, I don't know, like, there just seems to be this idea that, you know, I don't know, we just seem to be measuring them on, oh, you see, I simplify everything, but you know what I mean? Like, we just seem to measure them. You know, it can talk to me. Oh, it must be a genius. You know, like, it can, you know, it seems to be able to repeat things. It, you know, and it just, yeah, I'm really interested in this idea. I love it when you talk about the sea as an alien place. Do you, I love it when I talk to you, I always, and when I talk to you and when I read that book, I get the feeling that I am living in a weird place. And I really like that.
It's one of the attractions. I mean, I studied brown seaweeds, and brown seaweeds I find attractive because of the large organisms, and the most interesting organisms are probably bacteria, and they're probably the most unlike us, and they have peculiar physiologies, and they can metabolize all sorts of different energy sources. So as far as alien goes, bacteria are probably the most alien, but they're small, so they're not obviously apparent to us most of the time. But if scientists were honest, probably 90% of biologists should be bacteriologists, and the rest of us can deal with larger organisms, eukaryotes. But of the large organisms, the ones that are sort of exist on our scale or something like our scale, I think brown algae are probably the most alien, and that they live in a completely alien environment in rough seas, and they live in, and they're a separate evolutionary line in terms of multicellular organisms. Brown algae achieved multicellularity independently of animals, plants, fungi, which are the other multicellular lineages. So they're a sort of a unique multicellular lineage that grows in this unique environment. And I came into this from, you know, kayaking. I was kayaking white water and seas in the most alien environment I think I've been in is storm surf, because it's so far removed from a human environment. You know, this is not surf that's nice, tidy waves coming in like you see in surf magazines with flat water in between it. When you're in a storm surf, you're often in two or three swells coming from different directions. They're interacting and reinforcing each other. There's very little flat, steady water in between, and if there is, it's usually got chop at least. And everything is moving. There's no fixed points of reference, and that to me is as alien an environment I've been in for humans, because we tend to have fixed points of reference everywhere. But an environment where everything is moving is very unusual. I think it appealed to me to know what it would be like to be an organism that exists in that sort of environment.
Because I was just thinking how Solaris uses the language of liquid and ocean to describe the planet a lot, doesn't it? You know, like it's this movement that is slightly disconvolved. Do you know what I mean? Like, it seems to be, it's really interesting to me that we live next to this thing, which is the sea, and it is such an odd place. Like, it's so dangerous to us as well. Like, well, not dangerous, but I mean, like, it's so, we just have no way of living in it at all, really, unless we are on a kayak or, it's really weird. So,
well, we're very adaptable and we can live in it.
Yeah. You know,
some people, their lives are spent at sea or extracting things from the sea, or, you know, sponge divers or Japanese seaweed divers or something. You know, there's these whole cultures that have been built up about living around the sea. And I tend, you know, I think humans have probably evolved close to the sea. You know, coastal communities and coastal cultures don't fossilize very well because of coastal erosion, so we don't know much about the history. We tend to know more about the history of humans in areas where they have fossilized well, that is, you know, Northern Europe, where things were cold enough and people's remains were found in caves and things where they preserve well, or, you know, Central Africa or East Africa, where things are dry enough to preserve well. But coastal areas, I think human habitation has been mainly around coasts for what we know, but we don't have a very good record there because it changes so fast and cultures replace each other around coasts and they keep overturning. But I think we're probably a coastal species more than anything else.
Because this is what I love about talking to you, is that I think this is what happens. I don't know, it seems to happen so much in the media and stuff like that, where people, before I met you, I used to think that science had answers. That's what science was about. Science was about clear answers. But over and over again, you've managed to put grey areas into everything. And I really like how science seems to be about questions. And like you're saying, it's sort of like, right, well, we have to make allowances for the fact that there's erosion and, you know, people are turned over. And I'm just wondering, is that something What do you think science is for? Like, when you think about science, like, it seems like as crazy a question as what's art for, but what do you think science is for?
I like the story a lecturer once told me that he was... A student asked another lecturer what science was for, and the lecturer replied it was a quest for the truth. And then the same student asked this guy, and he said, oh, well, it's just a big game, really. And I think, you know, it is a game. I think, you know, scientists are interested in science and finding answers.
Mm.
It's a serious game. It's a genuine game, but ultimately I don't know if it's for anything. I think it's just humans trying to understand where they live. There's other ways of doing it. I like science. I think it's credible and can answer some questions. Just it can't answer. There's lots of questions it can't answer.
I love that idea that you were talking about right at the start about description, you know, like how this book talks again and again about the limits of description, and you know, like it is so often it seems that we're all, you know, like it is a quest that humans have, like to sort of work out where we are living and what this place is, and maybe even how we're living as well. We haven't really talked much about humans.
Well, science, putting things in order is an important part of science.
Yeah.
And it's an important starting place.
Yeah.
You know, if you want to start doing science, you should do some biology, do some natural history, go out and sit somewhere and look at things for a long time and questions will come up.
Yeah.
That's not... something that we spend enough time doing. I think I came into Solaris from the movie, and when I saw the movie, I think the Tarkovsky movie, I was excited about the idea of an ocean planet, because I was a teenager in the sort of Jacques Cousteau era that wanted to become a marine biologist, and then I went off and did other things, and then eventually I did study science and end up with a degree in marine biology. But I love the idea of an animate ocean of some sort. And one thing that I found when I was kayaking was trying to understand how salt water and fresh water differed. Because fresh water is, I mean, the obvious difference is seawater is more dense because it's got salt in it, but there's something else. There's the sliminess, there's the organic qualities, the foaminess about seawater, which is different, and it always seemed different to me when I was kayaking, and it felt like I was in a very different thing when I was in freshwater or seawater. And then, you know, only recently I found papers exploring the structure of seawater and how much organic molecules have made a difference to seawater and the way it's structured and the way organisms live in it, which, you know, it was a long way from I think anything Lem was really interested in. I don't know if he was interested in the possibilities of an ocean planet. I think that just happened, but you know, I don't believe in the sort of strong guy or idea that ecosystems are individuals or are really comparable to organisms, but I do think seawater is, you know, it's structured by the organic constituents which are a product of things that live in it. So there is a sense in which the oceans are an entity, probably not a thinking entity or and not necessarily a homeostatic entity like in Solaris, but I do still, you know, like this idea of that maybe an ocean could develop as an organism in some ways.
What does that mean, homeostatic?
Oh, it maintains its environment. So its environment static. So we're homeostatic in terms of electrolytes in our bodies and temperature. We keep all these things constant, and seawater does to some extent, except we can change slowly, as we've seen with acidification of seawater with climate change.
Because that was I looked this morning, I was looking at a couple of scenes from the Tarkovsky, is that how you say his name?
I think so. That's what I say.
Is that what you say? Am I saying it the same as you? That's good. And I was just thinking that thing you're talking about looking around your environment, there's time in that movie, isn't there? Like, there's time for looking around. And I was looking, I remember those scenes where he simply looks out the window of the spacecraft. And, you know, there just seems to be something. And, you know, it feels a little bit like Stalker in that way, you know, that there's time. And, yeah, I was always surprised at how small the book was. And I was surprised at the difference. You know, the book feels spacey. It's not spacey, outer spacey, but, you know, like, it feels like there's space in the book as well. And I don't know how he does that. I've got no idea how he does that. But, so did you see it as a teenager, did you say? Did you see the Tarkovsky?
Yeah.
And was it like anything you'd seen before? Like, were you into that type of film or that type of film?
That type of film? That I don't know. I mean, I was a geeky kid who read a lot of science fiction, and I was probably into watching science fiction films, and the idea of a Russian science fiction film was sort of more exciting than an American one. And I think Stalker probably had more impact on me as a teenager. But I think, yes, that possibility of time, because I like looking at things. And what I loved about Tarkovsky movies and still like is that you have time to see things, which I want to sit there and look. I don't know, some people don't want to, but that's part of science, you know. Part of science is taking, well, biology, you go into the field and you look for things and you find all sorts of things other people probably don't notice. You know, I remember at some stage I got interested in fungi, just eating mushrooms and identifying them, but it gave me a different way of looking, because I'd look and I'd have my head down and I'd be looking and I'd see mushrooms everywhere, you know, that other people would probably just walk past. I talked to a bird watcher and he said, well, one of the things about bird watching is you look up and he'd say, you know, and I start seeing things and other people don't see birds because they don't look up. And, you know, and I've got my head down looking for mushrooms, this guy's got his head up looking for fungi. It is a different way of looking at things.
Yeah.
And I'm always surprised in how interesting a mossy bank is or something like that. You know, you start looking closely and you see all sorts of things. So I think there's probably some correlation there. I liked movies where I could sit and actually look at the image for a few minutes instead of having it vanish immediately.
Yeah. I remember a walk that you and I took once. I think we had the girls out in the Botanic Gardens, and, you know, I've had a lot of my aha moments with you. We were walking and you were talking to me about the trees we were walking under, and for the first time ever, because I'm stupid, I realised you were talking about how some of the trees had evolved and some of them hadn't. And it was that moment where I thought, oh my goodness, trees were around when dinosaurs were around. I know that's stupid, but it was the first time that I'd thought these things are adapting and changing as well. You know, and I just, I don't know, like, I've never been able to walk amongst trees in the same way again. And I just think, oh, that just blew my mind. You know, like, I think we were talking about the Fibonacci, or it might have been the way the leaves were in a particular pattern so they could get the most of the sunlight or something. And I just thought, oh, I always look at these things and think they're random, you know, or they're patterned, or, you know, and they are random, you know. Like, I mean, obviously there's no great thing moving them around and making jigsaw puzzles, but I love the way when I, like I say, when I talk to you, I see things differently, and I really like that. It was incredible. It was an incredible walk. I wonder, Lem is Polish, and it's interesting. The book was written in 1961, so he is part of that Soviet. Is he? Like, oh, my history's dreadful. Like, that is Soviet times, isn't it? 61. So, like, because I often do think of him in. And I think it's because of the Stalker, you know, Stalker, Solaris kind of, you know, whatever. But I do often put him in there, and, you know, you and I often talk about Russian science fiction. And I'm just wondering, why is it so strong? Like, why do you think there is, like, I mean, Russians are great writers at everything. But I just wonder why the science fiction is so intriguing and interesting, and, you know, like, it just, I don't know, have you got any thoughts?
I don't know, I'm no expert on Soviet or Eastern Bloc science fiction. I think intellectualism was encouraged Oh, it was probably just fashionable in Russian society in ways that it probably wasn't in the West, mostly. Maybe that's part of it. I mean, chess is a national sport. It's, you know, it's different from a rugby culture, I suppose. But I think they were writing in science fiction to escape the confines of the system. And that, you know, Strugatsky's, the Russian brothers, were very much satirising the Soviet system. And I think it was Andre Norton who wrote an introduction to one of their books who said, you know, in the West, Soviet science fiction was often denigrated as being doctrinaire, dogmatic, Marxist stuff and not worth reading, but actually the American science fiction writers were more caught up by ideology than the Soviets, and that really the Russians wrote as free people and used science fiction to satirise what was happening in their own system. And because it was possible to write about an anti-authoritarian movement in another planet, but it was probably not possible to write about it. It was too close to home to write about that in their own set, in their own society. You know, have you read Aitmatov?
No.
You know, he writes, what is it, Day Lasts 100 Years. A novel which is mostly about camel breeding and looking after camels in Central Asia, you know, Russian Asia, and existence and life there. But then every so often there's a sort of little bit of science fiction that intrudes, and there's a contact with an alien civilization happening, and it's only, you know, a few paragraphs in every chapter probably. But maybe he needed to put the science fiction element there to escape the censorship if it had just been writing about the constraints of Soviet society and the possibilities of liberation in the Soviet society. But he could write about the possibility of liberation through an alien contact and get away with it.
Because that's like sort of segueing. Sorry, this is not like that. I'm totally changing subject. But I always, one of the things I'm interested about Solaris, and I think I'm right, is that the English version that we read is not directly translated from the Polish. That the Polish was translated to French first, and then we got the English version. And I'm also interested, you know, this idea of this being his serious novel, do you think it's less serious in Polish? do you think maybe it was captured as kind of like this, oh, you know, deep, you know, and someone translated it and perhaps, you know, somehow, you know, eschewed all the funny bits? Or do you think there's any possibility, or yeah, I don't know, am I just, who knows?
Maybe, yeah, I don't know. Translating humour must be terribly difficult. I don't know much about it, but, you know, certainly Lem's other stuff is more funny, and some of the Strugatsky stuff is very funny. You know, they do very witty little satirical bits, and it's not, you know, it's not grim-faced like a lot of American science fiction or something. You know, there's a sort of playfulness about it, which is quite witty, you know.
Because that's what I was thinking as well. I was thinking that, you know, this, I always have this theory, and I've never been able to ask a translator to explain it, but I sometimes wonder if we get into a rhythm of translating, you know, that we decide that Chekhov sounds like this, and that, you know, like, and that, you know, I don't know, Bolaño sounds like this, and, you know, like, we kind of get into this rhythm. And I always wonder that about this book, especially after talking to you about the humour and the other ones. I just wonder if we decided, because there is a seriousness, there's a real earnestness to a lot of Western science fiction. I was thinking that the other day, you know, like, I know we've got, you know, I always go to Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, and, you know, there are some funny ones as well, but there does seem to be sort of a, I don't know, looking towards camera and, you know, dum-dum-dum, and it's kind of, I was reading a conversation in Solaris this morning about God. You know, it's where he turns, I think he's talking to Snow, and he sort of says, you know, do you believe in God? You know, and it seems like I'd underlined it and just like, oh my God, this is the essence of this book. You know, it's about God. And then I reread it this morning, and I was just thinking, actually, this is almost a throwaway. You know what I mean? Like, it's just a wee funny You know, it is kind of, it is a little bit funny because it's sort of saying God, you know, but they're really like, oh, geez, I don't know, you know, and I just, I don't know, like, I don't know, humour must be impossible.
Well, that's very interesting. I remember my brother describing a conversation between Christian anarchists who are trying to understand why Paul was such an idiot, because he seemed to be deferring to the Roman authority, and they, you know, they reread this passage in the Bible, I can't remember which one, and they read it and reread it and thought, maybe he's joking. Maybe he's just making fun of the Romans. You know, maybe this is actually a bit of satire that you're not supposed to actually believe it. And how would that translate? You know, the Bible is so, you know, serious, and but it's been translated. Maybe it's been translated by people who didn't see the humour in it.
Oh my God! I so love that idea because I think, like, you know, like people do kind of think that. You know, like, this is serious and that's not serious, and oh my God, it's so hilarious.
I mean, I read a Strugetsky novella that had recently been retranslated, I think, directly from the Russian, definitely, maybe. And in that, it's also about scientists who are successful in their fields and then they reach an impasse, and they all seem to be reaching the same sort of impasse, and they're trying to understand why they can't proceed their work any further. They feel they're just on the cusp of some great. And they keep on getting distracted, but they get distracted by annoying little things like unexpected visitors turning up, or you know, the toaster breaks down, and they just can't seem to get to work that morning, and all these things happen, and it's very funny. You know, whereas I think in American science fiction, probably there'd be a shadowy government agency or a conspiracy or something, you know, grim and hardcore. Maybe that's the influence of detective novels or something, or
sort
of thriller influence, thrillers. Probably influenced science fiction more in the West than they have in Russia.
That's a really good point. I never thought of that. Because I was just thinking about...
Yeah, most science fiction films get remade as thrillers, even if the original was something of a science fiction novel.
Oh my God, you're dead right. Yeah. Like, because I was just thinking, we've been watching X-Files from the beginning, and that very much has sort of a police procedural feel. You know, well, they're CIA agents, so, you know, it always does feel like there's an art. There's some really good humour in that as well, but... You're dead right. It often does become that. Because that's, you know, I was thinking about the Soderbergh, and the Soderbergh definitely wipes out a lot of the, you know, it definitely wants to kind of wrap everything up in a slightly different way to the way that Tarkovsky does. But, yeah, and you know, like, I'm trying to think of that quote by Lem. I think what he said was something like, the Soderbergh was a translation of the Tarkovsky, and the Tarkovsky maybe shouldn't have been called Solaris, it should have been called Love and Spaceships or something.
Oh, I thought he said that about the Soderbergh version.
Was it the Soderbergh version?
I think so.
That should have been called,
you know, Chris and Hari have Find Love in Space or something, yes, you know, something
yes,
like that.
Yes.
And that it seemed to reduce it to a human drama about a second chance of resolving an unresolved relationship and so forth. Which is very disappointing for me, because I always thought when I saw the Tarkovsky version that, I don't think Tarkovsky was completely comfortable with it.
Yeah.
And that he's much more comfortable in Stalker or something, where he's in Russia and they're on the ground.
Mm.
I always felt a little bit of discomfort that he wanted to bring in the Bruegel painting and things like this, and it felt out of place, and it felt like he was really reaching back to Earth.
Wow.
So I thought it'd be interesting. You know, it'd be interesting to remake this and do it with partly good special effects, which I never really want good special effects in movies. I'm not very orientated towards it, but I always thought I'd love to see that ocean done well.
Yeah.
And then Soderbergh comes out and he makes it, and he takes out the ocean altogether.
Yeah.
And it's just amorphous sort of glowing ball of fuzz. It was a great disappointment. I thought, you know, if there's one reason for remaking it would be too interesting to show what this ocean looks like. But then he loses that altogether.
What was he thinking?
Yeah.
What was he thinking? I love that idea of harking back to Earth.
I think this is probably about verisimilitude as well in science fiction, and that, you know, X-Files, would it spoil it completely if it was a bit silly? It would seem like you have to have this earnestness to make it seem realistic, whereas I don't think the Russians are so bothered by that.
That's so true, because I guess, you know, like, I was just... There are moments in X-Files where ridiculous things happen and people do acted ridiculously, but the overall thing is that this needs to be taken very seriously. And I always wonder that about, you know, like, we've sort of been given this language of how we will react when the aliens come, or if the aliens, you know, like, it feels like, you know what's going to happen kind of thing, you know, like, because we've been shown so many times. But I do love the idea that it could just be a weird, uncomfortable cup of tea or something, you know. And so do you think, is what you're saying that you think that the humour isn't, the seriousness seems more realistic than
I think
humor.
It's an attempt to be more realistic.
Yeah, but I mean,
life is quite funny sometimes, so.
And ridiculous.
Yeah, so why should it be?
That is a really interesting idea that I hadn't thought about before, but I think you're right. I think, yeah, oh my God, that's kind of blowing my mind a little bit. But yeah, you're dead right. Like, it is that thing where, you know, we often think serious equals truth, you know, humour equals, you know, not truth, which is really weird. I can't think of anything else to ask you. Have you got anything else that you think you want to say about this amazing book?
No, I mean, it's a great book, and I'd like to read more of them. I'm always looking out for it, but it doesn't come up cheaply.
Do you think, why do you think that is? Like, I mean, like, do you think, yeah, what, I mean, the Strugatsky, is that how you say them? Yeah. Have they been translated quite widely, or?
I think they were also translated via German or something. Anyway, so we got second-hand versions. I don't know, you know, you occasionally find sort of cheap paperback versions of the Strugatsky, so I guess some science fiction publishers probably got hold of them cheaply and reproduced them. But I think they're being retranslated a bit more now.
Yeah. Because I don't know, like, when I was doing the PhD that same year, someone put out an e-book which was translated directly from the Polish, and I never read it. And I feel, it's that weird thing with literary translation, isn't it? It's not a simple translation of word for word and stuff like that. So I never read it, but I should read it. Yeah, I love this book so much, and I really appreciate you coming in to talk about it, because it's reminded me of how much I love it.